Observer.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. Each week, our half-hour program features writers from the Texas Observer and other esteemed guests for a conversation about the biggest issues in Texas politics and culture. In the studio this week, we're joined by Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Jonathan.
Also with us is freelance writer and regular Observer contributor Priscilla Mosqueda. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by John Wright of Lone Star Q to talk about the record number of openly LGBT candidates in Texas. But before we get to that, Denton is considering a fracking ban. If passed, Denton would become the first Texas city to ban fracking within its city limits. Priscilla, can you give us the background on this situation?
Denton is in the Barnett Shale, which is where the first place in the country that is densely populated to have heavy fracking. And so years ago, fracking started and people were generally okay with it because there wasn't a lot of information about fracking like there is now. And then eventually people started getting concerned as fracking got closer to what are protected uses like homes, parks, schools, churches, hospitals. And they
Can I stop you for a second? When you say information, do you mean about like what, like how fracking could potentially contaminate groundwater or earthquakes or what
yes.
are we talking about?
Yeah, all of that. I mean, that wasn't so much in the forefront the way that it is now.
Right.
People didn't really know about the environmental consequences. Water usage, air quality issues, water quality issues, earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
And so as that started coming up more, people started, you know, caring more and opposing it happening so close to their homes and to schools and parks and things like that. So some concerned residents formed a group, DAG. Before it was the Drilling Advisory Group, now it's the Denton Drilling Awareness Group, to go before city council and represent some of the residents' concerns about fracking near these uses. And the city formed a task force and started revising its gas drilling ordinance, which basically regulates how close fracking can be to homes, parks, all these things. And over the course of several years, the city increased a setback requirement to 1,000 feet and then 1,200 feet.
I mean, that sounds perfectly reasonable to me that they've like acknowledged that there was a problem.
Mm-hmm.
They've set these limitations. You can't be within this amount of space. I mean, problem solved, right?
Well, you would think. But the problem is that a lot of the companies had permits to frack that predate the ordinance. And so now those companies are claiming vested rights, which they're just basically saying, well, we had permits before the ordinance existed, so we can still drill, you know. And so in some cases, people live 800 feet within, you know, a gas well, 500 feet from a gas well. One of the families in my story lives less than 200 feet from a gas well, which when drilling is happening 24/7 for months, your house, you know, you can hear it, your house is shaking a little bit. And then the fracking starts, and that, of course, has a host of other concerns.
Okay, well, let's talk about the Drilling Awareness Group for a second. Exactly what role did they play in the proposed ban?
They created it. They wrote up the language, and then they collected signatures to get it on the ballot. So, actually, they collected signatures to force city council to vote on it, and then city council decided not to, and so that automatically got it on the ballot. And so now Denton residents will make the decision about whether or not to ban fracking.
One of the things I thought was fascinating about your story was the way that the petition drives have gone, and that the response has been so big, and they got, what, like four times the minimum number of signatures they needed on this petition to put this on the ban on the ballot. And then there was the pro-drilling group that passed around another petition using some different strategies, but that some people signed that thinking they were signing the petition for the ban instead. And so now there's just everybody seems really engaged in this issue, including the oil and gas companies, mm-hmm. sort of seeing that this could be a precedent for other cities around the country now too.
Right, yeah. So there's definitely been a lot of involvement. Like you said, they collected four times as many signatures as they needed. And then the other group had a counter petition, and some people, you know, pointed to that being a little bit problematic. It was worded in a sort of, they said it was misleading, and some people signed it and didn't intend to sign it.
You're signing that you don't want to not ban
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like some people said that somebody was quoted in the newspaper saying they told me that I was signing something that said that city council should vote on drilling. And so he was like, I thought that was a perfectly good idea. And then they called him later and said, can we run your name and an ad in the paper saying that you signed this petition? And he said no. And then a few weeks later, he saw an ad in the paper with his name on it, and he was really angry about it. And a couple of other people had the same story. So, I mean, definitely the oil and gas industry is getting involved, and they seem to be getting worried because they've spent a lot of money. Like XTO, which is a subsidiary of ExxonMobil, spent at least $75,000, and they only have one well in Denton.
Wow.
So it's, you know, it's pretty clear that they're at least concerned.
So what exactly is at stake here beyond Denton if this passes?
Well, like I said, Denton is in the Barnett Shale, and so that has some precedent-setting, you know, qualities. It's the first, you know, urban area, not Denton, but that whole area in right. Dallas-Fort Worth, all of that area, to be really heavily fracked. And so people are looking to it to see, you know, what happens. And basically, if Texas residents, you know, Texas loves oil and gas, if Texas can't handle fracking, that sends a message that other places aren't going to handle it either. And, you know, other states have already, like other cities have already banned it or are trying to ban it. New York cities now have the authority to ban it within city limits. Whether or not that can happen in Texas is something that's kind of going to be debated. So whatever happens, it's going to take a while because there's going to be legal challenges. One state rep said that he's going to file legislation making it, you know, banning cities from banning fracking, basically. So, but there's definitely potential beyond Denton and even beyond Texas as other places look to Denton.
I also loved in your story the way that there's this, when you imagine a bill coming up next session, it's you know, it'd be like banning the plastic bag bans. You know, we'll have freedom wells,
a bag ban
in all the cities, and standing up for the rights to do that. And
right.
And you can see it getting so heated and sort of escalating so much. And you pointed out in the story that, you know, if Denton is where this starts, or it becomes that you know, agitated, a high-strung political issue, it really didn't need to happen in the first place. Maybe some of the companies that had been operating in Denton just sort of, you know, abided by some of the ordinances that were already in place, or were a little more willing to sort of cooperate with some of the neighbors there.
Yeah, actually, I've pointed out a quote that I wanted to include here in the show about that. You're talking to an environmental activist named Sharon Wilson. She said, to the citizens' credit, they wanted to try every single avenue available to them to regulate it, to work with the industry, to work with the city. They did everything they could, and at every single turn, they were thwarted. Is that the case based on your reporting?
From talking to some of the activists and the residents, yes, that's exactly what happened. A lot of them said, as Patrick pointed out, like if it hadn't gone that far, if that one company or these companies in Denton hadn't gone that far, we probably wouldn't have gotten to this point. And that's how a lot of people feel. And, you know, Sharon is with Earthworks, and she even said other cities have called her, you know, wanting to know about Denton. And she said, if you can regulate it in your city without banning it, by all means do it. We just feel that in Denton, that's the only choice that we have left. Because, you know, like I said, they went before city council for many years and were successful in getting these setback requirements, but then the setback requirements haven't actually been enforced. You know, these companies are still drilling. And the problem is that once they have a lease to drill that land, they can come back and make more holes, basically, and then refrack existing holes. So it can keep going for many, many years in the same spot that could be 200 feet from someone's house. And so people really feel that unless they ban it, it's just never going to stop. And they don't want to live near that.
There was another thing I was interested in, too, and it's sort of the flip side. You know, in the pro-drilling groups are talking about the economic losses that Denton's going to see, you know, banning fracking. And I guess that's like property tax revenue for the school district that might be missing. And I'm interested in what other things are out there that Denton might be missing out on, and how you've heard some of the activists and people who are involved in this issue, like kind of balance out those two things and how they consider that lost money.
Right. So there's definitely been talk about the tax revenue that would be lost. And there's also a lot of talk about what mineral rights owners would be losing out on. That's been kind of a big emphasis from the pro-drilling side. But what some of the professors at UNT tell me and some of the residents is that for the most part, the mineral rights owners don't live in Denton. They actually live outside of it. So a lot of that money, according to them, I haven't necessarily like verified, but isn't going to Denton. And both sides have numbers about how much is actually going to the school districts, and so the pro drilling side says it's a lot, and the pro ban drilling side says that that it's not really that significant. So there is a lot of back and forth on that.
They feel comfortable enough saying no to that money in exchange for knowing that they're not going to have all this equipment and industry going on.
Yeah, exactly. And for the people living closest to it, like in those developments that I mentioned in the story, like the 200 feet, 800 feet, those people don't own their mineral rights. The developer in those cases didn't tell them that there would be fracking and then retained the mineral rights and then either sold them or kept them. But in any case, those landowners aren't even getting a royalty check from the fracking that's happening literally down the street. So to them, it's like...
they don't lose out on that much. Yeah.
So just real quick, one last question. Obviously, Denton is not the only city in that area to have enacted some ordinances about fracking. I know Dallas enacted some ordinances as well. What is the thing that makes Denton unique that has brought it this far, where they're actually proposing a ban? Is it just the loophole that we discussed earlier? Are there other aspects?
From my understanding, it is basically the loophole, because like Dallas, there wasn't actually fracking going on yet. It was going to happen, and there were some permits out there that a company had, but they hadn't actually used them yet. And even then, it wouldn't have been that close. It wouldn't have been like 200 feet. It would have been in like parkland, and there were some issues about it being in the floodplain, but it wouldn't have gotten so close to people. And so Dallas created a 1,500-foot setback requirement, which is the same, I think, that Flower Mound has, which basically people are, say it's a de facto ban. Like it makes it pretty much impossible to frack because you're always going to be close, but it's not like something written in the law that says it's prohibited to frack, right, like would happen in Denton.
Right.
No, I like the idea that it's, the Denton's music scene and the the bearded jug band contingent that helped really propel this, where the other Dallas suburbs wouldn't have taken it this far.
Yeah, exactly. It is different. It is like a very like a college town. It's a lot of students. It's the fracking forum that I went to was in a pub.
Pure stereotype, on my part. But that's how I always imagined.
Well, you are a former resident of that area.
Yeah, sure. So you're allowed. Can say that. Yeah.
I don't know if that's true.
Well, the story is on the fracking bandwagon in Denton. You can read it now at texasobserver.org. Priscilla Mosqueda, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Well, we're recording this episode on Thursday, October 30th. Early voting ends tomorrow. As you head to the polls, you might not be aware that there are a record number of openly LGBT candidates on the ballot. Here to talk to us about these candidates is John Wright, publisher of Lone Star Q and an Observer contributor. Mr. Wright, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
In your piece about Texas LGBT candidates, you start with an introduction to Louis Minor Jr., who it appears from your story is, well, at least the sense that I got is that he's a little bit less concerned with actually winning than he is with representing the LGBT community and sort of giving people a choice. Is that the sense that you got from him?
Yeah, I think Louis realizes that it's an uphill battle this year in that district, given that the Republican incumbent got over 60% of the vote in 2012. But he's also building. He wants to represent the LGBT community. He wants to represent the Democratic Party, obviously. But he's also building, I think, for the future, and he plans to run again in 2016 and even 2018, he said. So I think he realizes that this year the odds of actually winning aren't very good, but he hopes to just continue to build a coalition and a base in that area so that he'll have a better chance next time.
So in your story, you talked about, and I can't remember if it was you or if it was State Representative Celia Israel, who you mentioned that there might be a tipping point coming up where there would be a whole lot more LGBT candidates running in the state. We have more now than ever before, I guess. Do you have a sense of why it's building or what it's building to, like how far off that tipping point might be?
I think it's kind of similar. You could draw parallels with the sort of the same-sex marriage movement and the advances in that movement and the just tremendously rapid growth that we've seen over the last couple of years. And I really think having openly LGBT candidates is another sort of barometer of acceptance, along with things like same-sex marriage. So as you see acceptance grow, you'll see more and more candidates. And if you look at some of the more progressive states like California and New York, you'll see that they just have a ton of LGBT candidates and LGBT elected officials. And so it's just sort of waiting till we reach that tipping point of acceptance in Texas where it's no longer an issue and LGBT candidates are, you know, treated just like any other candidate and have a legitimate shot. At least that doesn't hurt their chances of winning.
I wanted to ask, because I know we're breaking records in Texas, but how does Texas compare to the other states?
Not very well. I mean, I think the statistic is there are like 510 or something openly LGBT elected officials nationwide, and of those, only 12 are in Texas. So when you look at the fact that, you know, Texas has a huge population with the second largest in the nation, and you've only got 12 out of 512, that's not proportional.
Right.
And that would be expected in a more conservative state. And again, the question is, you know, when is that really going to start to change? We've seen sort of an inkling of change with a couple of openly LGBT state representatives and, you know, the mayor in Houston and the sheriff in Dallas. But when is it really going to burst? And when are we going to start to see more proportional to the actual size of the LGBT community?
What do you think that would take? I mean, beyond support for same-sex marriage, are there other conditions that would need to be in place for that really to take off?
Well, obviously, I think, you know, as the state continues to turn blue, most LGBT people are Democrats and most LGBT candidates are Democrats. And so the more districts become viable for Democrats, the more districts will become viable for LGBT people. But also just, you know, I think as the community continues to get more organized and, you know, can galvanize around these candidates when a good qualified LGBT candidate does come up and we, you know, pool our financial resources and get behind them. Then just like you said, I think the growing acceptance, you know, especially in the rural areas, like, you know, it's probably very difficult still for a gay candidate in West Texas or East Texas to win a race. And so, you know, we really need to see the hearts and minds of constituents and voters change before they're willing to actually cast a ballot for a person who they know is openly gay.
You bring this up in your story, and I just wanted to hear you kind of talk about this a little bit more, but what you think the impact is of having more gay and lesbian state reps on the floor of the House, say, you know, and, you know, if the ledge is going to take up, you know, some kind of marriage equality type bill next session, and having Celia Israel or Mary Gonzalez on the floor there when those kind of conversations are going on, it sounds like, you know, from your story, I got the sense that like their presence there counts more than just their one vote. They're, you know, they can steer the conversation or be somebody who could stand up at that microphone and have a meaningful conversation about things in a personal way.
Yeah, I think, you know, to be honest, a lot of these legislators, especially from the more rural, you know, and conservative areas, may not even have ever met really an LGBT person. And then when you have one in the legislature, obviously they're getting to know that person as a person. And when you look at how far and how fast the LGBT equality movement has advanced, the whole key to that has been people coming out and being out, so that non-LGBT people can realize that LGBT people are just like them because they know one. There's one in their family or they have a friend. And so, and the same thing holds true for, you know, the legislature is that person, you know, changes hearts and minds at the Capitol just by being themselves and increases the level of respect. And so it's really critical. I mean, the Victory Fund, which is the national organization that endorses LGBT candidates, has said that, for example, just anecdotally, no state has passed marriage equality legislatively without having at least one openly LGBT person in the legislature. And so, I mean, that's just an example of how powerful that influence can be, is that the fact that, that pro-LGBT legislation really can't advance without someone there to champion it in that manner.
It really is. It's fascinating to me the way that, you know, you'll see there's like the high up political rhetoric and groups, you know, that, that some lawmakers want to support. But when it comes down to the personal level, you know, there's still like that collegiality around the House. And it seems like that's got to translate into, you know, at least changing their minds about some of the things they're voting on.
Yeah, I mean, so much goes on behind the scenes in the legislature. I mean, every committee room, I think, has like a little reception area behind it for the members, and there's refreshments and stuff, and they mingle and talk, and they attend all these functions together. So there's really like a camaraderie between them. And so, you know, when it's a family, it's a big family in some ways. And so when you have an LGBT person in your family, obviously you're much more likely to be accepting and supportive of LGBT issues.
A lot of the candidates that you either spoke to or mentioned in your piece talk about building networks. And I can't help but want to talk about another story that you wrote for us last week about Asia Edwards in New Braunfels. I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about her. Can you introduce us to her story?
Yeah, AJ Edwards is, I believe she's 33, and she's a native of the New Braunfels area, and she dated girls apparently as far back as like high school, but then she, you know, basically tried to be straight and got married and all that good stuff until she had a rough divorce, and then she decided to come out as gay or as lesbian. In the meantime, she had gotten elected to the city council. And so now she becomes New Braunfels' first openly LGBT elected official, and also one of only a handful of city council members in the state who are openly LGBT. And she's apparently been experiencing some backlash in locally, which is not particularly surprising. But she's also really, you know, making a positive effort to create a community in New Braunfels, which has really virtually none. There's no organized LGBT community in New Braunfels at all, from what I understand. And so she's trying to really build that from the ground up. She's, you know, really, it's pretty brave, I think, for her to do that and to come out even as a city council member in that conservative town.
Obviously, there was a little bit of pushback when that happened. Can you talk about what she's done to overcome the criticism that she's received?
Well, she's, I think, largely just ignoring it in the sense that she's not going to let it stop her from doing what she believes in. She's launched this Facebook group for LGBT people in New Braunfels that's gotten a ton of members, and she's organizing events. She's got a mixer planned at a local bar coming up. She's trying to create some sort of LGBT youth organization. Obviously, the youth are always the most vulnerable people, especially when they're not accepted by their parents or their church or their, you know, even their teachers
right. At
school. And so she's trying to build some sort of support network for them. She's just pressing on, and she's not letting the haters, you know, kind of detract from that, which is what you have to do, because you're inevitably going to encounter that stuff in anywhere, let alone in New Braunfels. And so you've just got to kind of brush it off and keep moving. I mean, there's no other way. Otherwise, you just, you know, it'll defeat you and you know, you'll lose, basically. And so she's fighting the good fight.
Would you suggest the same advice to the candidates mentioned in your more recent story?
Of pushing LGBT issues?
Yeah.
Well, and that's always sort of the sensitive topic, is LGBT candidates sometimes, you know, are reluctant to be adamant about LGBT issues because they're afraid they'll get pigeonholed, you know, as
right.
having the gay agenda or whatever, and or just being defined by one issue. But I think it's really important for them to do that on some level, because otherwise, you know, other people aren't going to do it. I mean, you have straight allies, and those are great, but they're just not, they don't know what the experience is like of being an LGBT person. And so they're never going to fully be able to relate to that or comprehend it. So they're never going to be as effective an advocate for LGBT issues as someone who is in fact LGBT. And that's why it's so important for LGBT elected officials, you know, to say, yeah, yes, I am, and these issues are important to me, and this is my community, and we want equality, and not to back down from those issues. So, you know, another important, this doesn't really relate to your question, but I think another important point is that obviously there are many, many more LGBT elected officials than we know about who are simply not out. And that's just another example of, you know, we need you to be out. You have to be open and honest about who you are. That's the number one most important thing. That's what's gotten this movement to where it is today. If you look at Apple CEO Tim Cook, who just came out today, I mean, that's just an incredible gain for the LGBT community to have somebody in the high-level corporate world who's openly LGBT. I mean, it's monumental. It changes everything. And so just the most important thing that any LGBT person can do, elected official, candidate, anyone, is to be out and to be open and honest about who they are, because that's what changes the world. That's what changes people's views on these issues when they know LGBT people. And again, they realize that they're just like anyone else.
Can we talk a little bit about the stakes at the legislature next year? And I'm interested in your thoughts on like how the legislature might make marriage equality its business next time around, or other things that you think are going to be issues new laws that might come along that are going to affect LGBT Texans.
Yeah, I would definitely expect some anti-LGBT legislation again this session. I mean, we've had it pretty much every session in history, but in modern history anyway. But I think the issue now is the new frontier is this issue of religious freedom, of them trying to carve out all these exemptions to same-sex marriage, for example, based on religious freedom. Like, the classic example is the bakery that won't bake the wedding cake for the same-sex couple.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so I would expect to see the Texas legislature try to expand, for example, the Religious Freedom Reformation Act. Last time they tried to actually convert that statute into a constitutional amendment and add some really, you know, bad wording to it that would make it, very extreme when compared to other states. And I expect them to try to do that again this year. I would also expect them to try to maybe get rid of these local non-discrimination ordinances. For example, the Houston fight that's going on now is over an equal rights ordinance. Other major cities in Texas have passed these. San Antonio had a huge fight last year. I wouldn't be surprised to see some sort of effort to try to undermine these non-discrimination ordinances or negate them and say, hey, you can't have these in Texas. That's just a couple of examples I can think of off the top of my head, but who knows what they'll think of. I mean, that's one thing you can never, I mean, last time they tried to ban LGBT resource centers on college campuses. So it's really, you have to be ready for pretty much anything, and you never know how it's going to come up. Probably try to tack it on as an amendment at the last minute and sneak it through. It's just, you really have to be on the defensive against these things.
Well, the story is Texas sees record number of openly LGBT candidates in 2014. You can read it on TexasObserver.org. John Wright, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for Observer Radio this week. But before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music. And of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at TexasObserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.